Both Democrats and Republicans now have a better idea who their nominees will be this summer. Just ahead, full election results from last night's primaries. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton roll to victory in Florida. We're taking your calls right now on Election 2016. Get on the line at 549-2937. Then later, a progress report on the Affordable Care Act in the state, or Obamacare. Going Green looks at sustainable solutions for your backyard and challenges facing the state's female veterans. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump easily won Florida last night in the state's key primary election. Tuesday's contests across the country, with more than 14 million votes cast in five states, marked a major turning point for both parties' presidential campaigns. Democrats and Republicans can now more confidently predict who the candidates will represent at the upcoming conventions in July, as both Trump and Clinton both hold commanding delegate leads. However, challengers John Kasich, Bernie Sanders, and Ted Cruz are not giving up their fight. Dr. Michael McDonald is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida, and he's on the line from Gainesville with thoughts about last night's results and the road ahead to the general election. Michael McDonald, a pleasure to have you on the show. Good morning.
Great to be with you.
And to our callers, give us a call with your thoughts about last night's primary results in Florida and what you think now about the general election. The number to join us, 549-2937. Go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect to email and tweet the show. And of course, you can always weigh in on Facebook. So Michael McDonald, as expected, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton rolled to victory in Florida last night. You've been quoted in recent days as saying that now as we start to turn more toward the general election, you're predicting what you call a hate election this November, where more voters will be motivated out of anger and negative emotions to turn out and vote, maybe against a candidate rather than for one. Can you explain a little bit more about that theory?
Right. So if we look within the Republican nominating contest so far, and we look at the exit polls, what we see is that Republicans are largely dissatisfied with their candidates. None of the candidates typically get over 50% support among the Republicans, saying that they would support that candidate going into the general election. And there's, of course, there's a whole movement in the Republican side called Never Trump, which is attempting to, and rather unsuccessfully last night, to stop Trump from getting the nomination. And again, what elected officials who have said that they would never vote for Trump, who are somewhat a part of this movement. So within the Republican Party, Trump is a very polarizing figure. And we already have indications that when we move to the general election, the Democrats will also be energized to vote against Trump. And so I think Trump is sort of the wild card here, is the polarizing factor. However, Hillary Clinton, who, again, at this point looks to be solidly in the lead on the Democratic side for the nomination, if she does indeed win the nomination, Republicans have been primed for years to feel antagonistic towards the Clintons. And so many Republicans will also be motivated. Maybe some of those Republicans who currently are part of that Never Trump movement will find Trump more palatable than a Hillary Clinton presidency. And so I think that, again, there's going to be a lot of anger that's going to motivate this upcoming election. We could see very high turnout come November as people see very stark differences between the candidates. And that would really bring them to the polls to make a choice that is very meaningful to them.
And we want your calls on what will motivate your vote this November at 549-2937. Let's talk about how Florida will play in November, Michael McDonald. If, in fact, the nominees are Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, that's not a certainty yet, of course, though, because, as I mentioned, the other candidates are all staying in. Marco Rubio ended his campaign last night, but John Kasich, Ted Cruz, and Bernie Sanders are still campaigning hard. Here in Florida, we have the country's third largest Hispanic population, growing ever more diverse around the state. Republicans do dominate the state legislature, but in presidential cycles, we are certainly the most key swing state in the nation. How do you see both parties vying to win this state and its many delegates in November? And how do you think Donald Trump's rhetoric will affect the GOP's chances, particularly among the Latino voter base in this state?
Right. So the Republican, quote-unquote, establishment had hoped that either Jeb Bush or maybe Marco Rubio would have been the nominee for the party. The idea would have been that they are candidates who have won statewide office in Florida in the past and would therefore be well-positioned to be favored sons in a general election to win the state. And then also Jeb Bush in particular had moderated his positions on immigration, which is something, if you recall, after the 2012 election, there was a task force that the Republican Party put together that looked at how the Republican Party might be able to win the presidency after two times, 2008-2012, failing to do so. And one of the recommendations in that report was to moderate their positions on immigration. Well, Rubio hasn't really taken that track, although he had waffled on the issue. Again, there may have been some hope that he could have pulled Hispanics back in. He did particularly well in Puerto Rico, and there's a very sizable and growing Puerto Rican population in Central Florida. Estimates 3,000 to 4,000 Puerto Ricans are fleeing economic troubles in Puerto Rico every month, and they're moving to Central Florida. And these are citizens of the United States, so they immediately have voting rights. So there was some thought that, you know, maybe Jeb and Rubio would be these candidates that would help the Republicans over the top in Florida. Well, Trump has definitely not taken that tack on immigration. And we're already getting some early signals that he will be, again, a very polarizing figure. National polls put his unfavorables somewhere around 75% among Latinos. There was recently a New York Times story which discussed how there are legal Latinos here who are immigrants, but in line for citizenship, and they are applying for citizenship at record numbers. And anecdotally, what they're saying is that they want to be able to vote against Trump in the general election. That could be very significant for Florida and for some other states, because in past general elections, if you look at non-Hispanic whites, non-Hispanic blacks, and then Hispanics, Hispanic turnout, according to the Census Bureau, is about 10 to 15 percentage points lower than that of whites and blacks. And so if a Trump comes in, he's polarizing, he appears to be punitive against the Latino community, that raises turnout rates among Latinos. That's a tough nut that the Democrats have been trying to crack for a long time, is mobilizing Latinos. That could put Florida out of play for the Republican Party in the general election. It could also move some other states like New Mexico and Nevada out of reach, potentially Colorado, and could put a state like Arizona into play. So that could change the map. But I do want to say, though, Trump is this very unusual figure, and he could redefine the election in some ways that we haven't, and the electoral map in some ways that we haven't seen before. Trump does very well among disaffected whites, and so
we're talking disaffected white Democratic and independent voters.
Well,
right?
Yes, the poor, less educated. You know, he infamously said after Nevada, "I love the poorly educated," because the exit polls show that they supported him. That shows up even again last night, and a lot of people have demeaned that, saying, "Oh, you know, ha-ha, the poorly educated follow Trump." But the truth of that is that these are folks who don't typically participate in primary elections. They have lower propensities in general elections, and his ability to draw those folks into an election is very significant, very important, because if he can pull those people in, that may offset what's happening with other groups that could be mobilized against him in a general election, and he might be able to again, redefine the Electoral College map by making states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, which are Democratic-leaning states, put them into play, maybe move Ohio into his column. So this sort of Rust Belt states may be his pathway to an Electoral College victory if he can't win Florida.
All right, let's go to your calls right now as we speak with UF's Michael McDonald about last night's primary results. As Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton win Florida, what are your thoughts about the election? What will drive your vote in November? It's 549-2937 to join the show. Eric is on the West Side. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. The common narrative repeated in the media and now has been adopted by the voters is that Washington has let the voters down. And I think it's the opposite. I think it's actually the voters that have let Washington down. And the reason I say that is because if you look at, for instance, on economics, we have one problem in America, and that's flat wages. And just because, so we have people coming along with solutions to the problem of flat wages, but because they're black or because they're quote-unquote communists, the voters choose to go in another direction. So here we have a problem, we have a solution that's offered by a politician, and then we have the voters going the other direction. And by the way, it seems to me that when I watch a lot of these votes and I hear people that are voting for Trump and what they're saying, it seems to me what these people want is blood. And so with Trump's comments about going after terrorist families, with his comments about beating up protesters, with his comments about Muslims and quote unquote thugs, and which we know is a thinly veiled word for black people. His comments about building the wall and how Mexico is going to pay for it, and it seems to me that a lot of what these low education voters want is blood. But so thanks for taking my call.
All right, thanks, Eric. That gets back to what you were saying, Michael McDonald, that you forecast a hate election. What about Eric's comments?
Well, there's one thing that we really do need to pay attention to over the summer on top of everything else that's happening. Right now, we're very much focused on primary electorates. They're much different than general election electorates. And although the economy is not doing as well as it might for everyone in the country, it's certainly improving. And you can see this, the unemployment rate's now down to 4.9%. Wages are slowly creeping up, although they've been very stagnant. Consistent with that, Obama's approval rating's moving up as well. So although there's a lot of anger on both the Democratic and the Republican side when it comes to sort of how the economy is performing, it has been improving, and it's improving to the point now where if we look at our forecast models of how past elections have played out, it's improving enough to the point where we would think that the economy is now a positive for the Democrats come the general election. Now, a lot of things can change between now and November. We could slip into a recession again. The rest of the world is sort of in a malaise at the moment, and we could be dragged down with that. But if the economy continues to sort of chug along at the rate that it's doing, right now we would put the economy as a plus. And so that sort of angst that's out there in the electorate right now may be muted when it comes to November, at least on the economy.
Bill in Jacksonville. Hi, Bill. What say you this morning?
I've been kind of keeping a tab on this. This is probably the most confusing election cycle since 1980 with Reagan. And looking at where things are going, are we looking at more like a brokered convention? Because I don't think that Trump could possibly even get enough votes to walk into the convention with what he needs to be nominated, right?
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right now, Trump is sort of right on the cusp of, if he keeps his delegate count as it is and continues to compile them at this rate as we go into the next half of the electoral calendar, he would just barely have a majority of the delegates. But That may not be enough. He has to win in some states that are blue, and he has not done as well in the bluer states as he's done in some of the, particularly in the South. And so it's possible that he could be denied a majority of the delegates at the convention and not be able to win on the first round ballot.
And do you think that the Republicans will see a contested convention?
It's possible. It's not out of the question yet. So while I think Clinton now has nearly clinched, again, it's still possible if things just completely collapse for her that she would lose the nomination. It doesn't seem likely, but it looks as though Clinton would be most likely a nominee. On the Republican side, Trump is just teetering on that majority that he needs in order to avoid a contested convention. So at this moment, we can't completely rule out the possibility that there will still be a contested convention.
And you mentioned, although Hillary Clinton is in the catbird seat for the Democratic nomination, Bernie Sanders has a friendlier primary calendar ahead in the next couple of months and will keep fighting. Here in Jacksonville alone, I've been asked to point out that the local Sanders organization set a record for phone banking and canvassing. So there are passionate Sanders supporters on the Democratic side as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was interesting in his speech last night that Sanders seemed to mute his attacks on Clinton. He may be accepting the reality, but he still has a very large war chest, and he has a lot of money to carry his campaign forward. His donors, again, they've been very passionate for him and given him and his campaign lots of money, small donations largely, to be able to move that campaign and power that campaign forward. And so what may be happening here is Sanders, and again, some signals here, we'll just have to see how it plays out. He may start using that war chest to aim more at Donald Trump than at Clinton, recognizing the inevitability now of Clinton's nomination.
549-2937. We're going to go now to Zoe in Orange Park. Hi, Zoe. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you.
Great. Go ahead.
My point is, and the question was, what will motivate me in November? What will motivate me will be the appointment to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. So who will you be voting for, do you think?
Hillary Clinton.
And that's due to how you want Supreme Court appointments to go?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that call. That's Zoe in Orange Park. You know, this morning at 11 a.m., Michael McDonald, President Obama, is expected to announce his pick to replace late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Meanwhile, Republicans have vowed not to even give that person a hearing, whoever it may be. What about the Supreme Court?
Well, these, again, are the big unknowns that we have. Up to this point, we've been really focused within these primary contests and the policies and the rhetoric that have been coming out of these among these candidates. The Supreme Court nominee is this moment where we're going to shift the attention to national politics and really stark differences between the Democratic and Republican parties on social issues and other important issues in the country. And it's these moments that have a chance to completely redefine the voters thinking about how this race should play out, and especially how the race is going to play out in November. So, and there could be other unknowns. That's just the first one. There could be another terrorist attack. Again, the economy could go south. All sorts of unknown things that could happen between now and November. So we can't really rule out what may happen between now and then and say with any certainty as to who would win in November, given that likely we'll see Clinton as a nominee and perhaps Trump.
Doran on the West Side. Doran, go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa. I wanted to ask a couple really fast questions. One, I'm wondering what type of or what quality predictions can be made about the Florida general election result based on the primary, given that independent voters were excluded from the vote. So can we really predict anything come November? Second quick question is, can Republican candidates who have earned delegates pledge those delegates after they suspend their elections to, let's say, Trump or Cruz, who seem like they're going to be the remaining remaining candidate for the Republican nomination. Okay. Those are my questions.
Sure. Go ahead. Thanks for that. Michael McDonald.
So the answer to the first question, do these primary elections forecast what's going to happen in November? The short answer to that question is no. I point out that everyone looks at 2008 as this comparison point, which is a high water mark of Democratic participation within modern elections and in these nomination contests. If we go back just one further contested election on both sides, 2000, the structure of competition was very similar. Al Gore versus Bradley, and then on the Republican side, we had McCain and we had Bush, but we also had a cast of other characters that were engaged in that election as well. And turnout rates in the 2000 election were higher on the Republican side than on the Democratic side, even more than what we're seeing right now. And, of course, Al Gore, as we well know in Florida more than anywhere else, did win the popular vote, but he didn't win the Electoral College. And so these turnout rates that we're seeing right now are interesting. I think they are fascinating. I don't think that they're insignificant. But on the other hand, I don't think that they necessarily forecast what's going to happen in November. Again, when we get into the general election phase, and if Trump is indeed the nominee of the party, his polarizing figure is likely going to energize Democrats in ways that we haven't seen the Democrats energize, much like he's energizing the Republican Party right now. So we have to wait till we get to the general election. That could be one factor. There are many other factors that we have to see and have unfold between now and November before we can say with any certainty what's going to happen in November.
Great analysis from you this morning from Gainesville. Professor, thanks for being with us.
All right, you're welcome very much.
Dr. Michael McDonald is a professor of political science at the University of Florida on the line for us this morning, and much more still ahead later. It's today's Going Green as we look at sustainable solutions for your backyard or office. But up next, checking in on the Affordable Care Act in Florida or Obamacare. Back in a moment.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Coming up on the next reveal.
Who asked you to give that money?
I don't recall who asked me.
A shocking discovery at a run-of-the-mill city council meeting.
I think it put, you know, right there in front of the public what I would have considered sleaze.
Money in politics, from Anytown USA to the presidential race. On the next reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through March 21st at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
On the next Fresh Air, former NPR foreign correspondent Ann Garrels talks about the lives of Russians far from Moscow. Though they face a struggling economy and widespread corruption, most support the country's president. Her new book is called Putin Country, A Journey into the Real Russia. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Global trade and the American economy. Who wins and who loses?
It's one thing to talk about software programmers. It's quite another thing to talk about workers with a high school education or less who started off in a factory job.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The latest installment of the Marketplace Edison Research Poll talks trade. Coming up next time.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's also known, is about 3 years old now. Here in Florida, more than 1.7 million people have signed up for coverage through the website healthcare.gov. The national total of enrollees is nearly 9 million, that according to the Department of Health and Human Services. On Monday, the First Coast Free Thought Society will host Tony Penna, the North Florida Regional Director for Enroll America. That's a nonprofit with the mission of spreading health insurance coverage. We have a preview right now as we welcome Tony Penna to Studio 5 to discuss the status of the ACA or Obamacare. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good to see you. And the number to call in with your thoughts and questions about the ACA or Obamacare is 549-2937. Now, your talk is titled The American Healthcare System from A to Z in 30 Minutes or Less. good luck. Good luck with that. You know, the controversy over the Affordable Care Act has something, in fact, to do with how complex our healthcare system actually is, although that, of course, isn't the only controversy.
Our system is very complex. You know, when we take a look at the Affordable Care Act, let's remember that it's 6 years old. Open enrollment periods, we've had three, and we've seen just tremendous growth in the number of people who now have insurance. On a national level, there's about 20 million people who have been insured under the Affordable Care Act. In Florida, as you said, it's about 1.7 million. And in Duval County, we now have 104,000 people who have received health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The original estimate when we began this effort was that there were about 150,000 people in Duval County who did not have health insurance. So about 70% of that original number now are insured. So if we look at that, we can see that the Affordable Care Act has, in fact, been a raging success.
And, of course, you are a supporter of the Affordable Care Act. Polls continue to show a divided electorate when it comes to the legislation's popularity. It's an extremely partisan type of position. Healthcare is very personal and emotional for people. You know, this morning in the Florida Times Union, an editorial looking at the woes and anger of the nation's shrinking middle class, and I'm going to quote from this, writes, "Reform Obamacare to provide less control by government, more use of markets, tax credits for people without health insurance through their employer, guaranteed continuous coverage, and more flexibility for states." Criticism from the right about the legislation. What's your reaction?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When we take a look at it, we've heard that Obamacare is socialized medicine, and it's not. What Obamacare did not do, what the ACA did not do, was take the insurance companies out of the equation. So what we're seeing is, in fact, capitalism. We're seeing competition among insurance companies for new customers, which are impacting rates or rate growth. So while there are many arguments against the Affordable Care Act, we're finding that a lot of those arguments fall short.
Like what? How so?
Well, we've heard from the beginning that people wouldn't enroll for the Affordable Care Act. And what we're seeing is that among all demographic entities, we're seeing that people have, in fact, enrolled. We've heard, as an example, that young people wouldn't enroll. We've seen the rate of uninsured in the 18 to 25-year-old demographic decrease by 8%, Hispanics by 9%, the black population by 7%. We've seen it decrease by 5% in the 35 to 64-year demographic. So we've seen success across the board. We've also seen the Affordable Care Act very, very positively impact the cost curve of healthcare expenditure in the United States.
And can you be more specific about that? Because one of the ongoing criticisms about the Affordable Care Act has been that it isn't cost-effective enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think on a macro level, what we're seeing is that the cost curve for the American healthcare expenditure is definitely decreasing. We're also, there was a report by the Commonwealth organization a couple of days ago, Commonwealth Foundation, that we're also seeing, because of the Affordable Care Act, a $1.7 trillion savings in Medicare over the 2011 to 2020 period.
Let me ask you as well, here in Florida, the legislature declined to expand Medicaid for low-income residents. That leaves close to 1 million people in Florida without access to low-cost insurance under this act.
That is a fact. In order to qualify for the Affordable Care Act, one needs to be working, and one needs to be making a minimum income of $11,750 a year. Anybody who falls below that level is not eligible for inclusion under the Affordable Care Act. So in those states that expanded Medicaid, they can now go get Medicaid. In the state of Florida, since we chose not to expand Medicaid, they have no choice. So they fall into this gap, and this gap is a black hole. They can't get insurance under the Affordable Care Act. They can't get insurance under Medicaid. So what they now have to do is rely on a lot of charity care.
And there are a number of nonprofits that try to stand in this gap, like Volunteers in Medicine comes to mind, and others. And so as the Supreme Court upheld this legislation, and Republicans are no longer campaigning as strongly to repeal and replace this act, how do you see this legislation evolving over time as calls do continue to tweak it, change it, fix it, and so forth?
Well, what we're seeing is that a lot of red state governors have expanded Medicaid. John Kasich in Ohio, as an example, did that. The governor of Pennsylvania also did that. So what they're doing is they're expanding Medicaid and allowing those people who don't qualify for the Affordable Care Act to now get coverage under Medicaid. The reason they can get coverage under Medicaid is because if they do in fact expand Medicaid, they're getting federal funds to do that because of the Affordable Care Act.
And here are some tweets from listeners. The only reason people have enrolled is due to the penalty we'll be charged. Of course, that was the most controversial piece of this, the individual mandate and paying a fee if you don't get covered.
I'm not really sure that that's the only reason why people have enrolled, to be perfectly honest with you. We've seen people enroll who have never had health insurance. We've seen people enroll who now have the opportunity to go to physicians and get care. So the penalty is certainly an impetus to some folks to enroll, but we believe that the majority of folks are in fact enrolling because they need insurance, because they need medical care.
And there have been strong testimonies, even from people who were opponents of the Affordable Care Act, saying they changed their mind when they had a life-threatening illness and they were able to get low-cost insurance.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there remain strong critics. Here's another tweet. I have lost my health care due to Obamacare. My health is more important than capital gains for businesses.
Well, there are people who've lost insurance. I don't know this person's particular case, so I really can't address it. A number of people lost insurance because the plans that they had did not conform to the Affordable Care Act. They were catastrophic plans that covered absolutely nothing. And since they didn't conform, the insurance companies were required to delete those plans and shift folks over to more compliant plans.
John on the West Side. Hi, John. Thanks for calling the show. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I have two issues, if you don't mind, about the healthcare.
Yep. Go ahead.
Healthcare. Okay. I took it last year because I was actually compelled to because of the threat of a fine. I'm retired, been retired for 2 years. I'm a 64-year-old man, couldn't afford regular insurance. But the only insurance I could afford through Affordable Care for Florida was a $30 a month premium, which gave me a $6,000 deductible, which meant I'd have to go into the hospital for something really serious for it to even help me out. But I did it because I was compelled to with the threat of a fine. So I did it. 6 months into that program, in the end of June of last year, I was accepted into the VA's health care. They said, this will meet your need for Obamacare. You can drop your insurance. I called that insurance company, Coventry was the name of them, and told them I was canceling the insurance because I was now protected under the VA's program. They acknowledged it on the telephone. I wasn't given any further instructions. But recently I received a form from the Affordable Care Act showing that they had paid $497 a month to Coventry for the entire calendar year of 2015. And I called them and asked them, I said, why did you pay them that money? I said, I wasn't with them but the first 6 months. And they told me, well, you didn't call and cancel it with us. I said, well, Coventry didn't tell me to do that. You did not tell me to do that. And so I'm thinking, if the U.S. government paid them $497 a month, and I really was not a client of that insurance company any longer, that is federal fraud for them to accept those monies when I wasn't even their insurance client.
Okay.
Can you respond to that?
All right. Thank you, John. Tony.
John, a couple of things. The first thing is, yes, now that you're covered by the VA, you don't have to apply for insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The issue with Coventry would seem to me to be an issue that is between the insurance company and the government. The insurance company was supposed to have notified the government that they were not covering you anymore because you had shifted over to the VA. The fact that they didn't do that was an error, and they can the government can now go get reimbursement for the amount of monies that they paid Coventry for your policy. And this happens regularly. You know, it's the bottom line is the insurance companies have efficiencies, and in some areas they don't have efficiencies. And this is one of the areas that they still need to work on.
In the meantime, you can learn more about this Monday night as Tony Penna speaks at the First Coast Free Thought Society at the Buckman Bridge Unitarian Universalist Church. That's Monday at 6:30 p.m. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
Back in a moment.
WJCT and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit now through April 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT, and I'm bringing some friends with me.
Everything with Al Letson as the host and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Everything. It's a new show, because we're going to do everything we want.
Everything. The opposite of nothing.
On the next I Am Ream show, results from Tuesday's Republican and Democratic primaries in 5 states, the latest delegate count, and the outlook for the rest of the presidential nominating race in both parties at 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Some of them are worthless. Some have infinite value. And some, you'll never know how much they are worth until you have to cash them in. On the next Snap Judgment, from WNYC and NPR, we proudly present The Promise. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's disturbing to note that female military veterans here in Jacksonville are suffering from high rates of depression and anxiety, and say they're lacking the help they need to find good jobs. That's according to a new study by Northeast Florida Women Veterans, the University of Florida, and the Women's Giving Alliance. 47% of the veterans surveyed say they're depressed. Just about as many report anxiety disorders, and quite a few, 31%, report PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. This news out just as we mark a week of recognition for Northeast Florida Women Veterans. Dee Quaranta is executive director of the organization and joins us now with more about the results. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
We talk a lot about challenges facing veterans, but in particular, female veterans are also struggling just as much as the guys, if not more. Yes?
This is correct.
Yeah, and we're talking anxiety, depression, PTSD, and trouble finding good jobs after they've served. So disheartening.
It is very disheartening. And if you believe it or not, when you say that there is a issue with employment, a lot of that stems right back to mental health issues. Because if you are having trouble sleeping, you have anxiety, PTSD, it affects how you just totally operate in your life, including finding suitable job or even being able to retain employment.
Now, this week is the third annual week of recognition here in town for local female veterans. There's a research project, Restore Her, that you'll be discussing with these findings today at 1 o'clock at FSCJ downtown, and you're going to try to help connect more of these brave women who've served to resources.
Yes. Yes.
Tell us about it.
There are a lot of community resources out in the community, but I think that a lot of our female veterans don't know they exist or don't know the services that are available. Mm-hmm. And so today we will get some feedback from our female veterans who may not have taken the survey and just find out what they feel is needed in our community, and also read the findings and get some feedback from our women veterans that will be in attendance today, because we will need that for our action after action.
You want women veterans to come out today, or loved ones of women veterans, to learn what they can access.
Yes, of course. And to give us feedback, because we do have an advisory team now that will come together and put together a strategic plan. So we need to get input from the community.
And so this is open to anyone who has an interest in this, whether they're military or not.
Community partners, military, females, and males, because it affects the whole family. Family members, caregivers, this is an important day for us.
It is a big day. And in this veteran-friendly community,
yes.
It's frustrating to get this information because you'd think this would be a city that would be doing a better job. We've got to do a better job to support this community.
That's correct. And I think that our partners are doing a good job. It's just about the advertising, getting the word out that they do exist. So we're going to get better.
Again, this meeting is today at 1 o'clock at the Advanced Technology Center at Florida State College Jacksonville. That's the downtown campus on State Street, revealing a new research project, Restore Her, and celebrating female veterans. Anyone with an interest in this needs to come out to this at 1 o'clock today.
Yes.
As we mark a week of recognition for our female veterans. Dee Quaranta is president and CEO of Northeast Florida Women Veterans. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us. Hope to see you today.
We'll be right back.
Global trade and the American economy. Who wins and who loses?
It's one thing to talk about software programmers. It's quite another thing to talk about workers with a high school education or less who started off in a factory job.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The latest installment of the Marketplace Edison Research Poll Talks Trade. Coming up next time.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
For everyone creating their own life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. sponsored in part by AARP Real Possibilities.
On the next Fresh Air, former NPR foreign correspondent Ann Garrels talks about the lives of Russians far from Moscow. Though they face a struggling economy and widespread corruption, most support the country's president. Her new book is called Putin Country, A Journey into the Real Russia. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's a growing trend for home and business owners. Ecological and edible landscapes that are both beautiful and practical and sustainable. And that actually includes everything from capturing rainwater to putting in a backyard chicken coop. Garrett Yopes, principal designer, and Kevin Lewis, regional director with Eco Design Solutions, are here now with more about all this. It's today's Going Green. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, and so there's a lot to talk about, but right off the bat, I have to ask you about the trend that's made the most news in Jacksonville recently, backyard chickens. That's just part of what you guys do, right? Yeah. Helping people do that.
Yes, it is just one part of a holistic design. It's great that we just passed that measure to have chickens in the backyard now. They're wonderful friends. In the garden, they do microtilling, they eat the bugs, they create fertility, and you get fresh eggs.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a win-win-win in so many ways, but that's just a little bit of what Eco Design Solutions is working on. There are lots of other trends for sustainable home and office space design in the outside space. Everything from water features, passive irrigation, rainwater capture, and a lot more. What else are you seeing?
Well, what we do is basically, it's from the top down, so we're taking everything into consideration. It's not just water features, but our water features capture rainwater to be used in the garden. Everything is interconnected in our landscape plans. So
yeah, all the pieces work together. It's a holistic
exactly,
approach, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, and you completely transform a landscape.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Now, with the focus on sustainability, are you finding that people see that as a nice feature, or are they really being driven by that desire for sustainability when they do this?
Well, you know, the sustainability factor gets us recognized. It gets us on the map. It gives us credibility. Oftentimes, though, we might think of sustainability as not being beautiful enough. Compost bins, you know, ugly rain barrel, water catchments, et cetera. But we want to focus on making it, appealing. We want to put this in.
It's got to look good.
It's got to look good.
Yeah.
You know, with the number of HOAs out there as well. And just, to have that quality of life of having good aesthetics on your property as well as feeling good about doing the right thing.
Let me ask you about the role of HOAs, because often homeowners associations can get into conflict with homeowners when they want to do, a Florida-friendly yard, as it's called, with native plants and so forth. How do you handle that?
Well, it's a case-by-case thing, but, sometimes we might have to work in the backyard. We typically like to bring the aesthetics and production to the front yard. But, it's a case-by-case thing, so we have to work with the HOA, obviously, and unfortunately. But even if it's going to be aesthetically beautiful, it's...
We've got a quick call for Eco Design Solutions. It's actually, we don't have time to do that. We are almost out of time. But, sorry, I didn't mean to cut that person off. But, this is our Going Green segment. And people, as they're increasingly focused on this, what's the bottom line? Because I'm sure that's also something that comes up with your customers. They want to do this. It might cost a little more. How does it pay it forward in the long run?
Well, we need to take responsibility for our land and our environment. So regenerating the soil, keeping the river safe is great. You can hire us to do it. We make it really pretty and we put all our effort into it. But there's also a great community here in Jax called Permaculture Jax. Wonderful community. There's a network of resources. Find them on Facebook. Become friends and, they'll all come out to your yard and put in an edible landscape for you.
Yeah, that's right. And we didn't even mention that. We're talking edible landscapes as well as...
Yeah. As well as ecological.
Ecological ones.
Yeah, when you work with nature, we create the fertility, enough to grow, production plants as well.
Very nice. Well, thanks so much for being here, guys. Garrett Yopes and Kevin Lewis of Eco Design Solutions. It's today's Going Green on the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Bye.
That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Make sure to subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and make sure to watch the show now, video on demand, at our partners TVJax.com and MetroJacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, results from Tuesday's primaries in 5 states, the latest delegate counts, and a look ahead to November. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.
This Going Green segment is brought to you by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jacksonville.